Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion titled Lost in Unification, Post-Cold War Europe, East and West, Remembering the Berlin Wall. The discussion is presented by the BU Arts Initiative, the BU Center for the Study of Europe, and the Goethe Institute Boston. Our speakers are German filmmaker Martin Persiel, Boston University Professor of International Relations and History Igor Lukas, and Polish author Agata Piszczek. We begin with an introduction by Professor Lukas.
We're here gathered to celebrate a most joyful, and I repeat it, joyful event, the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism. Perhaps the most moving thing I have ever seen in my life is a brief clip that you can see on YouTube where a Polish lady TV announcer says, "Good evening, ladies and gentlemen," in her Polish that I'm not going to imitate. And then she says, "Communism in Poland." And then she chokes on tears and says, "Has come to an end." And I often think about this simple sentence, how simple it was to announce it, and how hard it was to get there. So today we're celebrating, we're observing, we're commemorating the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism. And we have a panel here that consists of, if I may start in the order of the presentations, Martin Persiel, who is a German filmmaker, and he knows quite a bit about Germany, and that will be his main focus of the presentation. I will talk about some unusual aspects of the end of the communist era, and I will invite you to help me speculate about the causes of the end of the whole communist thing. And certainly last, but absolutely not least, we have the Polish author Agata Piszczek here, who will look more into the future. So may I invite Martin?
But also to the past and the present, hopefully.
All right. This is a free country, so Martin.
All right. Hello, everybody. I'm not prepared. In the sense that I've actually never talked in front of an academic audience. I'm a filmmaker, so my business is to talk about emotions and to catch parts of what human life was and is and wrap that into something that's ideally entertaining. So my focus is probably very different from the focus of those two. And yeah, I think, so I'm here because I made this film that talks about a very small subculture in the eastern part of Germany during the 80s, the very, very small subculture of skateboarding, which was something that happened, I guess, in the States since the 60s, and then in Western Europe since the late 70s, and then it sort of appeared all of a sudden in the East without any real connection to the West. It appeared almost by itself. I thought that was an interesting topic, and I made a film about that. And how I got to that is going to be my discourse. I'm born in 74 in the West, Berlin, because my dad didn't want to go to the army. And in West Berlin, as West Berlin was an island of democratic materialist society in the middle of the I love the way you say end of communism. Because that gives it such a bad name, like communism. But anyway, that's probably something we're going to get to a little bit later. I think it was the end of something else, but we're going to get there. So West Berlin was a little island of supposed freedom in the middle of socialism. And
say supposed, you mean it really?
Yeah, you know, I mean it in the sense that I think now that we in the Western world face very similar problems, even though we are living in the supposed free world. But we're going to get there. I'm going to be quick. So my dad didn't want to do that stuff. He was a beard-wielding communist, actually, but living in the West. And then, so I grew up, soon after we moved to the West. I'm born in 74, so when the wall came down, I was 15, which means I was well aware of what was happening, but I didn't really, I mean, I had other things in my mind at the time, like really 15-year-olds and world history, that normally doesn't go very well. Or that just doesn't link up. So I met my first people from the East 3 years later, probably, when it became more normal to bump into each other on the street. I then went to Britain to study and live for 4-5 years. Then I lived in Spain for 8 years. I lived in the Philippines and I lived in Brazil. So I've done my round in the Western world to then at some point discover that I want to do a film that's going to be personal. I want to do my first feature film. And I want to rediscover something that I'd left when I was early 20s, which is my where I'm from. So I went to Germany in 2009. And had left in the mid-90s. In the mid-90s, it was still kind of post-reunification. There was the rebirth of neo-fascism. There was people being killed for being foreigners. There was Asylantenheim. How do you say Asylantenheim?
Yeah, like, asylum seekers.
Yeah,
asylum seekers.
There was fire being put to asylum seekers' homes, and so it was a kind of weird. To my mind, kind of like a weird, dark, and violent era. And when I came back in 2008, we had hosted the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup, which is obviously a big thing in Europe, which had made a big difference. And there was a whole different vibe to the place. It's actually quite a fun place to be right now, Germany. So I decided, let's make a film about that, about joy and about Germany. And then it was going to be a comedy at first, about these sort of badly dressed dudes that want to be cool and they want to be skateboarders. But the more I got into the research of it and doing interviews with the guys that are all my generation or just a little bit older, and I realized that, yes, it's a story of how of aspiration towards the West, as a lot of people in the East had. They were looking towards the West and they were trying to maybe dress in a Western way, and everybody knew that the East was kind of done in the 80s. But it was also, for that generation, a story of really closing the door to a part of their childhood. And a lot of people from the East, I don't know if you guys are going to be able to confirm that, say that being a child in the East was actually really amazing. Because you couldn't compete so much in the way you dress, because everybody dressed the same. You couldn't compete so much in what you do, because everybody's doing the same. Everybody's in the same youth club. Everybody's doing sports. There's no social insecurity in the sense that there was no unemployment. There was. Yeah, I'm just trying to piss you off.
Well, I'm already.
No, you know that there was all these things that if you're a kid and if your little sphere of what freedom is for you is basically what you do around the house,
then we should all probably move to North Korea and then we're going to be very secure all the time. Right?
Then you don't mind world politics, I guess. So I did all these interviews for this film, and as I was talking to more and more people about their childhood in the East, I realized that it has comedy, it has fun moments, but it's really a story about a biography of people who have grown up in one system, and then there was this day that we're celebrating today that changed their lives radically. And that they were now confronted with, okay, this is the new thing now. This is what you're supposed to be living in and enjoying. And most of the people from the East, when the wall actually did come down, really welcomed the West and welcomed the idea that now it's going to be, the shelves are going to be full again in the supermarket and that they have opportunities to actually evolve. They totally welcomed that, but they also had to say goodbye to something. And the producer of my film put it into a very simple phrase. He's from the East, and he said, anybody in the world, you for example, that comes from a certain country, can, and then they live in Boston or they live wherever they choose to live, at some point they can say, okay, I'm going to go back to where I'm from, I'm going to find my roots, I'm going to be there for a month and visit my family. No matter, you know, that applies to anyone apart from Eastern Germans. Because that was a country. That was Germany as a whole had really split up and had been like that for, I don't know, 40 years. So that's two generations. There was two separate countries that share a language and share a heritage, but it's two separate countries. And suddenly the one country was just eradicated because it wasn't a merger. It wasn't like, let's take the best of socialism and the best of materialism and find out something that's going to be amazing. No, it was, okay, that didn't work. Let's forget about that, and let's just make the circle a little bit bigger, and this is Germany now. So he said it like, anybody can go home, and we can't. And there's a lot of sadness in this, and there's a lot of nostalgia in it, where you will find when you go to Germany and you talk to people, from the East, that they will always have that little tear of nostalgia also about the East. And that little bit of memory that it was also good. It was also very socially warm. It was also culturally interesting because it wasn't so cynical and sarcastic. Like if you look at music or even movies, I guess, there was something, some trust in values that I think in the 80s, especially in the West, the West had already shed that. The 80s were all about finding out what are we going to do now? This is postmodern times, and we're not evolving anymore. We're now getting into a loop, and we're being postmodern, and there's retro trends in culture and fashion and everything, and this was like a whole different era. And in the East, it had been a succession of, okay, let's try to be a little bit more free. Let's try to be a little bit more funky. And it was just going, I digress. The film that I made is about how life in the East had also been very colorful, because people are colorful, and because especially when they're young, they're all the same, exactly the same. When you're 15, what you care about is the first kiss, the first thing you stole in the supermarket, and the first fire you put to a rubbish bin. That's what you do when you're 15, and that's universally true for any 15-year-old, and that's what I try to put into a film. And that's why I'm here. And other than that, I really am not an expert on anything. So I can just hope that I can be of any help for these fine people and their discourses.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I don't know whether I should comment on what you've said or whether I should simply go on with my own presentation, but... Let me just make one quick comment. I know that some in the West often looked down on those who had escaped from the East, and they called them banana fresser, people who basically come to the West for material benefits, just to devour bananas and to buy jeans and Walkmans and so on. And it's true that 15-year-olds everywhere have a certain scale of value that's probably comparable. But the 15-year-olds in the East were required to join the communist youth. And if they failed to join the communist youth, then they couldn't get into the university. And if you couldn't get into the university, they said, come on and serve in the army for 2 years. With our Soviet brothers, whom you must love, whatever you think about them.
And who are going to be delighted to hear that you didn't do the pioneer service when you were 15.
It doesn't matter what I did or what I didn't do. The point simply is it is great to be to focus on the universality of a 15-year-old. But what is unique about a totalitarian system is that the 15-year-old cannot be just the 15-year-old, because the state claims ownership, you see, whereas in a free society, you can carve out, with the help of your family, obviously, your own zone of existence. But that's a different issue.
Maybe
we can get to it in a discussion. I simply wanted to invite you to help me think about the causes of the end of the Cold War. If you dislike the end of communism, I am perfectly fine with the end of the Cold War. Or why is it that the Berlin Wall came down? If you actually followed the media at that time, as I'm sure all of us really did, except for our students here who were too young, you probably remember that the journalists went really all out to remind us of the sort of beautiful poetic aspects of it. They spoke about the triumph of the spirit of liberty, and some even brought up Hegel and the sort of eternal quest for the absolute, and all of this, all these great, great words were piled up on top of one another. And I think many of us really were wrapped up in the sort of momentum at the time. But when we now, 25 years later, look back at those events, we realize that those things were pretty complicated. Let me start very quickly by bringing us back to the end of 1947, when Secretary of State George Marshall wrote a memorandum for President Truman. It was a sort of tradition that before the end of the year, the Secretary of State would sort of sum up the opinion of the Foreign Service apparat for the benefit of the president. And Secretary of State Marshall said that the Soviet Union was very likely to take some drastic measures to complete its control over Eastern Europe, that some of the enclaves of freedom would be completely eliminated, that henceforth the Soviet Union would rule through naked force, but, wrote Secretary of State Marshall, this rule will not be forever. He said, one of the most dangerous moments to world stability will come when someday the Russian rule begins to crumble in Eastern Europe. And it occurs to me then, looking back, that 1989 was exactly that year when we really danced on the edge and things could go either way. And in retrospect, you really understand why the policymakers, whether they were in Washington or in Moscow, London, Paris, or Bonn, had every reason to be nervous. The traditional view that the Cold War came to an end because of Western pressure that had been brought to bear upon the Soviet Union, I find to be at variance with archival evidence. If you look at what the West was telling Soviet leaders, and specifically Gorbachev, there is no indication that they were pushing to dismantle communism, to dismantle the Soviet Union. In fact, in January 1989, this is 1989, Henry Kissinger traveled to the Kremlin secretly and behind the back of the American embassy in Moscow with a letter that was signed by Vice President Bush, then president-elect, that's Bush Senior, in which letter he offered a grand bargain to the Soviet leaders. And the grand bargain essentially meant you keep your tanks in Eastern Europe on a short leash, and in return, we promise we will not interfere with your legitimate national security interests in Eastern Europe. When the American ambassador at the time in Moscow discovered what was going on behind his back, he really was outraged, and he wrote a very sharp note to Washington that had this initiative been revealed to the public, especially anywhere in Eastern Europe, it would have seriously damaged American reputation. Nevertheless, I believe that this was the view of many serious people in Washington who thought, well, the Soviet Union has over 20,000 missiles. It is becoming less and less stable. And who knows who will seize control over the nuclear codes, the football, as the Americans call it. If you look at other capitals of the world, you discover that there was also no enthusiasm for challenging communism, driving it away from history. You discover that there, in fact, were delegations coming from Poland, coming from Hungary to Chancellor Kohl, and they told him in advance that their intention was to declare neutrality. At that point, nobody dreamt about joining NATO and, you know, that sort of thing. But they at least wanted to consider to go on record as going at some future point going to seek neutrality, a neutral status for themselves. Chancellor Kohl's reaction was anything but supportive. He pointed out that the presence of the Soviet troops in in Central Europe is the consequence of World War II. It has a certain stabilizing, influence upon the international scene, and he strictly urged, strongly urged, the Poles and the Hungarians to go very, very slowly and to be very, very careful. The same was true, by the way, about the Chancellor of Austria, who also, as you can imagine, because of the proximity, had dealt frequently with the Hungarians. And the Hungarians, too, were all out to leave the Warsaw Pact. And he was pleading with them to completely abandon this destructive project. And he, too, repeated the sentence that the presence of Soviet troops in Central Europe is a stabilizing factor on the international scene. If you look at the French, you discover that President Mitterrand was very keen on seizing control over the EC, as the EU used to be called at the time. He very much wanted for France to become the dominant force in the EC, and any sort of dramatic changes in Eastern Europe did not fit into this scheme of things. And he, too, was very, very negative when various delegations from Eastern Europe came hinting at the possibility of breaking up the communist bloc. The same was true, perhaps more so, about Margaret Thatcher, the supposedly anti-communist British Prime Minister, who, in fact, believed the very opposite. Not only did she not believe that one should dissolve the Warsaw Pact, she hoped for the Warsaw Pact to be modernized, and she envisioned a world, this is, I'm following archival evidence, she envisioned a world in which a modern NATO and modern Warsaw Pact would pretty much control the planet and keep it stable and peaceful. Her Secretary of State said something to the effect that the Cold War is a system with which we have lived happily for the past 40 years. There is no need to rush things. Gorbachev, of course, was a hugely important catalyst for change. In fact, his willingness to launch, after 2 years of not doing very much, in 1987, to launch the Perestroika and, importantly, Glasnost, that did create the very important sense that in that new environment, one could do new things that would have been unthinkable before. But he certainly did not intend to dissolve the Soviet Union. He certainly fought for the territorial integrity of the Soviet Union until middle December 1991. He certainly, in August 1991, said that he was a communist and a believer in communism, and that he was going to die a believing communist. So certainly one should not think that Gorbachev was the man who somehow dismantled communism. Many people, when I talk to them, tell me that I downplayed the role of John Paul II. As a churchgoer, I often resent it, because, in fact, I think that John Paul II was the genuine article. He really, really was a believing Catholic. And as such, he fully embraced the position that was outlined by the Polish Church, by Cardinal Wyszyński, in 1953, in front of the Santa Anna Church in Warsaw, where he read the encyclical Non Possumus, in which he essentially said, we are a religious organization, we are men of the church. Our business is not to make or unmake governments. We're not interested in fighting communism. We accept Caesar, but we shall rather die than surrender our freedom to defend God. And that, I think, was the genuine view of the Polish Church. And so the Polish Church was certainly willing to go to the barricades for the right to work toward the salvation of the souls in Poland, but not to the barricades in order to overthrow communism. That was not the intention. Father Popieluszko was a rebel against the church. And the church really spoke to him in that vein repeatedly and tried to sort of send him to the Vatican as a troublemaker who really shouldn't be making all these waves. If I can just make these two, three points regarding John Paul II, just consider that the country was put under martial law 3 years after he became pope. And if you now read the accounts of the importance of the pope, you would think that he basically owned the country. Well, yes, many Poles were, our pope. Certainly, he was hugely important. He was the most important Pole. That is all true. But 3 years after he became the pope, Jaruzelski imposed his will upon the country as an agent of the Soviet Union, and the country really buckled under that pressure. 2 years after his first visit, the martial law was imposed, and for another 8 years, the country remained a communist, with JP being at the Vatican. So, in my opinion, the external players, whether it was Washington or London or Bonn or other Paris, other places, I think did not play a decisive role. So the second possible view is that it was the internal actors. And the internal actors, obviously, were Solidarity. And there I completely take my hat off and totally concede that, yes, Solidarity, with its almost 10 million members, really created a parallel society, an alternative, legitimate society, and a legitimate alternative to the officials in Warsaw, who were perceived to be in the pocket of the Soviet Union. But outside Poland, the dissident movements were irrelevant. Charter 77, famous Charter 77, and so on. It had something like 1,000 members in a country of 14 million. That doesn't strike me as an overwhelming power of the dissidents. In Hungary, the dissidents were focused on environmental causes. In Romania, dissidents were probably, one could count them on the fingers of one hand. So again, I would have to say that it was neither the external players nor the internal actors who brought down communism. And so, in conclusion, I would argue that, in my opinion, communism came to an end because the communist ruling elites had long before lost any faith in the lies that they had been advancing in their official lives. And when they saw that the changes could be brought about peacefully, the changes from communism to democracy, and they saw it in Poland, in the round table talks in Poland, they were encouraged that one could walk away from power and not end up hanging from the lamppost. Because the old fear of the communist elites had been for years that we will be hanging from the lampposts. But when they saw Solidarity peacefully discussing a transition from communism to democracy, with people like Jaruzelski simply retiring from public life, I think the communist rulers were encouraged by this. And I will conclude by quoting just a few lines from a poem that was written by Adam Wajek and published in Poland in 1955, and it created a sort of revolution. In this poem, Wajek reveals the hypocrisy of the communist bosses who, quote, charmingly foretold that lemonade would flow in seas. Does it flow? They drink seawater, crying, lemonade! returning home secretly to vomit. That, to me, is sometimes the poet is really, you know, has the ability to sum up a very complex issue. Here you had the communist bosses who had promised that lemonade would flow and cease. And so people say from time to time, well, go, tell us empirical evidence, does it? So they drink it and they say, lemonade. And then they rush home secretly to vomit. And I think the roundtable talks in Poland told the bosses in Budapest, in Prague, and elsewhere, that it was possible to simply go from one to the other. General Mielke, the famous security chief in East Germany, summoned at some point the generals of the Stasi, and he insisted that they each report from their sector on the situation in the country. And they went on through their sort of blah, blah, blah reports, if this, then that, and with the provision that this, and unless unexpected things happen, then we think that this and that. And at some point, Mielke, who was an old sort of communist warrior, he had murdered two police officers before World War II, he slammed his fist on the table and he shouted this beautiful German phrase. He said, in the end, it's only a question of power. Nichts weiter. Nothing else. It's a question of power. And the Stasi generals just shrugged their shoulders and sheepishly sneaked out. And I think this is what happened with communism. And I think T.S. Eliot was quite right to say that the end will come with a whimper, not with a big bang. Thank you.
Okay, it's really priceless to be talked at about your own country by an authoritative man, you know, when you have to wait your round, you know, for like, I don't know, 40 minutes. It's really priceless, I just wanted to say. And quoted Adam Wajcik at you as well. Adam Wajcik, by the way, who was a believing communist, one of the first signatarians of like of the Polish Manifesto of the Communist Country in the Communist Poland in the 1944, and somebody who wrote a poem for grown-ups or for adults, because precisely he was so disappointed with the Stalinist period, in the project of communism in which he so ardently believed. And And you know, many people were criticizing communists from the inside, but not because they were anti-communist, but because they really believed in the project and they wanted to see it reformed and not degenerating. And I think that especially after Wajcik wrote that poem in 55, since the 56, and until roughly 1968, Poland was having a relatively, I would say, good period. That was the greatest period of real socialism in Poland, definitely. And I was supposed to talk about the present and the past, or the future even. But this book is about all of those things, and I'm definitely speaking from the position of the young generation who has been hearing about, you know, all of those great words about freedom and communism and how we crushed them. You know, it was rammed through our throats, and some of us couldn't stand it anymore. And even in Poland, which has been, as you rightly pointed out, had the biggest anti-communist democratic opposition in the form of Solidarity, and in which communism was much more like forced, I would say, than in other parts of the Soviet bloc, to get like any criticism of the current situation, of the capitalist transition would be it's definitely much harder than elsewhere. I don't know if you've heard that, for instance, in the former Yugoslavian countries or in Bulgaria or in Romania, people are actually, you know, recently protesting against neoliberalism. In Poland, it's still to be seen. And I think it's precisely because, you know, despite, you are probably right, or even definitely you're right, that it's true that communism has been brought to an end because Communist Party just resigned, basically, and then, formed in the course of the negotiations of the round table with the opposition. But all of those things that you were mentioning that are not true has been told us for years that they were all true. And it doesn't really matter even if they weren't true, because they had a tremendous propagandistic and rhetoric effect on all of people's minds. So everybody, a lot of people believed really that it was Reagan, Thatcher and Pope that brought down communism. Church has an extreme stronghold in Poland on Polish, not only mentality but also on Polish politics. Because precisely of its mythical anti-communist role during communism, so now, for instance, it's being influencing all of the realms of social and political life, so that, for instance, all of the civil rights or women's rights that we had during communism has been reversed today in Poland. There is an almost absolute ban on abortion. There is very difficult to get contraceptives. There is no in vitro, and there is difficulty in getting divorce. And Catholic Church gets a stronghold, for instance, on education, on sex education, and many, many other aspects of public life. And it's all due to the role during communism. So despite, even if in reality, like you pointed out, Catholic Church didn't really bring down communism in Poland. Because of the myth that it was repeated constantly that it did, it had tremendous role on post-communist Poland. That's why it's important. All of those myths were circulating. Myths about freedom, myths about the free world, the role of America, and all that. So I think it's kind of important to remember that, because this is things that, despite they weren't true, they influenced very real politics. And I guess that precisely I represent, I guess, this new generation that kind of doesn't want to repeat the same kind of rhetorics, how we beat in communism. And also, I really don't like the way the period that was 45 years lasting is kind of interpreted and talked about as it was a solid kind of, monolith. And very, very often, period of this 45-year-old period, or even post-communist period, is still being interpreted only through the lens either of Stalinism, or even earlier today, I had a talk. I was attacked that I am a Gulag apologist. Or the Stalinist purges. It makes no sense. How a very long period, several generations, a very rich period, lots of things happened. It was a time of constant tensions, relaxations, big workers' strikes in Poland. There was several big, workers' strikes, during communism that were changing the status quo. They were changing, the situation. They were relaxing, the politics of the party. It shouldn't be like that, and unfortunately, with the end of real socialism, because I prefer to call it real socialism or really existing socialism, because it wasn't really communism. Communism was a project that wasn't really finalized. We are talking here about a project that is being judged constantly on the basis of, in the Marxist ideology, in the Marxist philosophy, this wasn't communism. That was really existing socialism. And it's funny, because when you were repeating the word materialism for the West, I kept thinking about dialectical materialism. This is very funny. No, because you were saying materialism, and I was for consumerist West. So, I think it's really unfair. And in my book, Fear Not, I am really assessing very often in a quite critical way the past, but I felt that it has to be done, and also somebody, let's say my age, and not by a reverend, somebody from the kind of dissident generation or something like that, to kind of first show that people in my age already can write history. Secondly, that you didn't have to like witness, eyewitness or like be there overthrowing the Berlin Wall to be able to talk about it, for instance. I mean, I was alive for six or seven years when that happened. And I don't want, for instance, it to be to discredit me that you can't talk about something that you didn't live through, because you know there are books, there are archives, there is research, also there is oral history, and actually I talk to a lot of people, and actually quite a lot of people, not only in East Germany, but like also in Poland and in other post-communist countries, were actually saying quite similar things that you were saying that people are saying in East Germany. You know, that that was also like that. That was not, some kind of a never-ending labor camp with, Stalinist labor camp. But it was a time in which people were enjoying solidarity, were enjoying, equality in the sense that everybody had more or less the same, less competition. People were having, there was employment, people were having jobs, and so on and so forth. And for instance, yes, there also existed something like compulsory, membership of, for instance, of youth organizations. But once again, that existed in the most authoritarian moment of real socialism, later, and in kind of critical moments, like later on, I think after 56, it was much less compulsory. It's not like everybody belonged to the Communist Party. Really, there was a lot of prominent writers, artists as well, people who were like kept making films and publishing books and so on, for instance, in Communist Poland, that weren't members of the Communist Party and weren't in the youth communist organizations. So once again, it's unfair and kind of slightly manipulative to kind of interpret this kind of vast and very diverse period only through the lenses of absolute wars and kind of nadir situations. I think, yeah, that's the most important, and we kind of, funnily enough, kind of focused more on the past, but precisely my book is making argument on the basis of what is happening right now, because I think it's like unfair and almost like insane to today, for instance, I am being very often attacked in Poland for what I write in the UK, where I live and I published, and I also publish in Poland. I'm trying to publish commentary from this kind of, leftist critical point of view. I'm being constantly attacked precisely talking about contemporary times, 2014, financial crisis and so on for 6 years. I am being attacked on the basis that I am a communist apologist. I mean, there is no...
Because there's a problem with capitalism?
Let me finish. Yeah. I think it's insane to say that there is like you can't criticize the outcome of the end of communism and the kind of capitalist transition because there was Gulag. I mean, it's insane. I mean, what those two things have, in common? Absolutely nothing, And I don't want to, the current generation, and the current, not only generation, but the current, Polish society, for instance, or the society in Eastern Europe that is facing a massive financial crisis, brain drain, recession, and so on and so forth, and all this trouble, to be held to ransom by some, things that happened in a different world like 70 or 50 years ago. I mean, I think it's insane, and it's just like, it's pure propaganda, and, but you have to, unfortunately, you have to constantly point that out, because I think that there is some kind of image of the real socialism and of this past that has kind of galvanized and is existing at this constant horrible labor camp with absolutely nothing like interesting and pure horror going on all the time that is undermining any discussion about current situation, neoliberalism, capitalism, the transition, and how politics is going on today, and how the policies are being enforced, in those countries. And there is lacking because of that, because of that kind of ideology. It's we are lacking a proper conversation and discussion and debate on problems that are touching us today. For instance, dramatic lack of housing, privatization, unemployment, brain drain, the fact that, like, for instance, in Bulgaria, there's up to 70% of professionals that are going to, you know, migrating, for instance, to Germany. I mean, this country is completely wiped out, you know? And everybody say, this country, there is no point for us to sacrifice ourselves or to study or to do anything for this country, because look at it, it's poor, it's dismal, there's no jobs, there's nothing. And like, nobody gave them the critical tools the power to kind of think why there is such situation, why there is unemployment, why there is a destroyed infrastructure, why there is no money, no subsidies, no investment. And I blame partly, this post-communist, anti-communist propaganda. We have anti-communism without communism. We have, for instance, in Poland and in many other countries in the Eastern Europe, also anti-Semitism without Jews. And currently we have also Islamophobia without Muslims, you know? And that's the situation. Even though communism has fallen or ended because it imploded, because it was so inefficient and so, it could only exist because if there was constant, for instance, loans from the West. For instance, in the 70s, we made very big loans. Our first secretary made from the West. So 70s were quite prosperous in Poland. But then in the 80s, IMF has called us dead, and we were in gigantic crisis. So, it was a system that clearly didn't function properly as it should. But it was definitely not what is being described right now. And I think that we are lacking this debate, and I'm willing in everything I do to instigate that debate and to, first of all, to drag the discussion of what is happening right now and how to solve those problems in Europe, for instance, and not to constantly be held prisoner to the past. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Elizabeth. So a couple of things. I'm a little afraid to open debate and discussion because I don't want you to feel like you're being attacked again.
Okay,
so
sorry.
Please stop me if you feel in
okay,
any
no,
way.
Okay, no, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry.
No, I just don't want you to feel attacked.
Okay.
So there are a couple of things that you're forgetting. The films and books that were made and published still had to go through the censorship.
I can easily answer that one. Okay, so with culture... obviously there was censorship, but like I said, there were also tension, relaxation. So, for instance, in mid-50s, after Stalinism, you could make quite provocative and critical films. Then there was another political crisis in 68, and after that, films were going to the shelf. Then in the 70s, again, you could make films that were very critical. I don't know, for instance, Andrzej Wajda, I think, is very well known in the States. You got films like Men of Marble and Men of Iron that were like about very, very critical, and also about Wajda himself, who has been some kind of a regime director. I mean, he was making lots of very expensive films under communism. But I see it, I think it's a simplification to see artists as those kind of sheep who are just being directed by the party. I mean, if you read memoirs and if you actually study, for instance, the way the film industry, because let's focus on films, because films are interesting case because they were the most expensive. And you really couldn't, you can write a book without the help of the state. You can't make a film without big financing. And not only we should be aware of that, but I consider those artists, people of the likes of Andrzej Wajda or Polish School of Film, or later we had something that was called Cinema of Moral Concern, like Krzysztof Kieślowski is very well known, or Agnieszka Holland is like made a career in the States. I consider them, if you actually look closely at the early films, they were not purely like simply anti-communist, but they, I think, were critical, again, of the system, and they were fighting for some kind of socialist with the human face. I think they wanted to reform the system. I think that they still kind of believed that they can play within the system, they can play with people who are making decisions, and, you know, they can... And that's why, because of that internal struggle, and also because culture mattered enormously, because exactly the culture was this understood by the society as this kind of way to read between the lines and communicate what is the truth. What, you know, like parties telling us the lies, we are looking for the truth in art. You know, those films are fantastic, and I kind of hold until today as wonderful works of art. And somehow after 89, this compass of mutual enemy, of public funding, of state funding, of the kind of whole infrastructure that went with it, you know, so, film studies and so on, and last but not least, the audience that were craving for the films that would be talking about the real state of things, that has disappeared, and our culture and our cinematography is in deep crisis ever since. You know, people kind of don't know what to talk about. For instance, they were so good at criticizing socialists, but they're completely inept in criticizing, you know, capitalism and kind of seeing for what it's worth. And I think that it only the image is completed if we see it through the lens of this later situation, you know. Plus, you know, censorship was everywhere. And like I say that censorship has been replaced by private funding, that like you can't make films that you're financiers won't, you know, that won't sell. You know, culture didn't have to sell. Didn't have to sell anything, didn't have to be purchased. It was independent. It was truly... And now it's not. Now it has to be commercial.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. I hope you were not bored.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a panel discussion titled Lost in Unification, Post-Cold War Europe, East and West, Remembering the Berlin Wall. The discussion was presented by the BU Arts Initiative, the BU Center for the Study of Europe, and the Goethe Institute Boston. Our speakers were German filmmaker Martin Persiel, Boston University Professor of International Relations and History Igor Lukas, and Polish author Agata Piszczek. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.